We use consult questions to dive into ID clinical reasoning, diagnostics, and antimicrobial management. I'm Sarah, your host, and today we are joined by many guests, primarily from our champions of the Pediatric ID Fellows Cup, the team District of Contagion. So I'm going to have everyone quickly say hello and introduce themselves, and then we'll get started.
Hi, everyone. I'm going first. I'm Marisol Ruedaltes, and I'm actually not a current member of the team, but former fellow at Children's National. I'm currently a PEDS ID attending at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and I was part of the organizing team for the first PEDS ID Fellows Cup.
Hi, everyone. My name is Roya. I'm one of the third-year ID fellows here at Children's National. Thanks so much for having us.
Hi, my name is Sarah Banky, and I'm also one of the third-year ID fellows here at Children's.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lillian Flanagan. I'm one of the second-year fellows here at Children's National. So happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Einar Helgason. I'm also one of the second-year fellows at Children's National. Very nice to be here.
Hi, everyone. I'm Berkay Balkanju, and I'm a second-year fellow also at Children's National.
Hi, guys. I'm Hannah. I'm one of the first-year fellows at Children's. Thanks for having us.
Hello, my name is Katarina Manzi. I'm one of the first-year fellows at Children's National as well.
And I'm Alexandra Yance. I'm one of the attendings in the PEDS ID group at Children's National and a former fellow. So happy to be here with everybody, including our former fellow, Mari Sue.
Hey, everyone. I'm happy to round out this group of the District of Contagion. I'm Netta Harik. I am an attending in infectious diseases here at Children's and the program director for our amazing fellows.
I love it. I'm smiling so big. I think this may be a record for number of fellows that are currently on an episode, which is super exciting. So we've made it through another year. We always take the last episode to celebrate our anniversary. So this is the fifth anniversary of Febrile as we wrap up 2025. I really just always want to make sure I share gratitude and appreciation. There's a lot of people who volunteer their time to be on the show. And then, of course, those who listen and support and share the resource with others. And as an junior faculty member myself, I do sometimes struggle to get the episodes out to you, but I am doing my best. We want to make sure it's still thoughtful and engaging and really just a good resource for everything that's awesome about ID. And so today we will include our usual update on the US ID fellowship match, which we've done in prior season wrap-ups. And then we're going to chat with our guests, go through some of those most missed questions from our recent inaugural first round of the Pediatric ID Fellows Cup. But first, of course, as everyone's favorite cultured podcast, I have to hear everyone's little piece of culture, your kind of year-end picks, things that you have enjoyed. Who wants to get us started?
All right. I'll go first. And I already warned the group that I'm going to be very uncultured. But it's the only thing that I can think of about myself that is a little bit interesting. So English is not my first language, but my biggest sort of school of learning how to speak English conversationally was watching sitcoms. So I'm a huge Friends and The Office fan. And the one thing I can think of is this, because just last week, my husband and I won like a big Friends trivia competition and won like $100 and a bunch of Friends.
Wow.
And it was really obscure, guys. Really, really obscure. We're pretty proud of ourselves.
Congratulations.
I was going to say, Marisu, if you didn't say Office or Friends, I was going to be disappointed.
My little piece of culture. I've been here for 2.5 years now for ID fellowship, but about a year ago, I moved into actual DC proper. And I love my neighborhood because there's always new like restaurants, new coffee shops, and like lots of fun things opening. But the one thing that opened up recently that I'm really excited about is a new macaron place that's like right around the corner from where I live. And what's even better is they have the like French hot cocoa there, the like really indulgent, like essentially you're sipping chocolate and it's very good.
I can go next. So I am not sure when this kind of started, but I feel like the holidays, I've associated it with gnomes. So I kind of started collecting gnomes. They come out like only during Christmas once the tree's up. And I just was gifted a felt needling kit to make a gnome. And so I have made And it is a lot larger than I was thinking. I'm very excited for gnome season.
That's the only way I'm going to call December now, gnome season.
Yeah.
Roya, I'm definitely going to have to come visit you so we can go get some macarons and hot chocolate. Yes, AB. I have probably every single year, at least once or twice during the holidays, watched the Muppet Christmas Carol, without my entire life. I watched it right after Thanksgiving, and I feel like it's time that maybe I watch it again. I feel like we need to be some of that in our lives right now. So that's my Christmas culture to contribute.
Love it.
If I'm supposed to name any piece of culture that I'm kind of obsessed with right now, it would be a little piece of Icelandic culture that my parents-in-law brought with them last time they were here, which is those little candies that are like chocolate-covered black licorice. I'm not sure if just everyone would want it.
Controversial.
That's like an evil hidden surprise.
My son hates it.
We're mean. Yeah, this is Berkay, and I was just thinking through the films when I saw that we are going to come, we are thinking through what we really like this year, and I was just thinking through the movies that I really, really like this year, and I recently saw a movie called Perfect Days, and I mean, it blew my mind. It's about just the joy of living and finding joy in small things, and I think it was very timely, and I enjoyed it a lot. Highly recommend.
Two thumbs up.
That's a great movie.
I think for me, so I'm not usually super into music, but I was just gifted a record player. So I've really enjoyed listening to a couple records lately. I like to thrift. And so I found a Fleetwood Mac old record and some Stevie Nicks as well. So I really enjoyed listening.
On my commute in, I like to listen to audiobooks or podcasts. And I really enjoy the Moth podcast. I never can anticipate whether I'll be sobbing by the end of the episode or laughing out loud, but it's always a good.
That sounds like a risky bet, Katarina.
To do it in the privacy of my own vehicle.
Absolutely.
Second favorite podcast after Febrile.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm Alex, and as everyone in this group knows, I'm a huge nerd beyond ID, and I also ring in a handbell choir, actually a community organization. And this is definitely our busiest season. So all of my weekends in December are nonstop concerts, private events, those sorts of things. So if you haven't ever checked out the handbells, this is a season to give it a try.
All right. And I'll go last. I feel like I've got a lot of things to choose from, but I have to go with the one that's most timely right now, I think, for me and all of my family, which is we are huge Stranger Things fans. So I think,
yes.
Oh my God. Lately, we did a lot of streaming over Thanksgiving. No one can wait for the next episodes, especially for folks like me who grew up in the time that the show is based. It's just so much fun to watch it. I just love everything about it. I know everyone's got their theories. We won't delve into theories, but I feel like our conversations lately have been all about what's going to happen in the next upcoming episode. So yay, Stranger Things.
I love it. Yeah, I was just rewatching some of the early ones, and they're so cute and talented. They're so great.
And tiny. Yeah.
With high powers.
Oh, well, thanks, guys, for sharing all those awesome things. So, like I mentioned, we like to just quickly give an update on Match. And I will say congratulations and welcome to all of the new incoming ID fellows. We now have at least 272 new adult ID fellows and 44 incoming pediatric ID fellows. So
yay!
Coughing and excitement. Yay! And
welcome,
you know,
welcome.
You know, this year's numbers are a little bit down. So here are the updates as far as the results for this current most recent appointment year. So I'll start with the ID stats for the adult folks. So there were 184 programs, 83 filled, which is about 45%. Last year, that number was about 50-ish percent. And then we had, for certified positions, there were 447 total, 272 positions filled, which is 60.9%, which compares to what was about 70% last year. And so that leaves us with a good number of positions that are available. And maybe I'll hand it over to you just to give an update on the pediatric numbers.
Perfect. Okay. So I'm going to give the data for the pediatrics programs for 2026 start in pediatric fellowship. So there were 60 programs that were certified this year in the match. And of those, 27 programs filled, which is 45%. That is up a little bit from last year where we had 42.2% filled. There were 33 programs that were unfilled, which is 55%. There were 86 certified positions. 44 of those 86 were filled, which is 51.2%, and 48.8% of the positions were unfilled. So I just want to say to listeners that are out there that are thinking about a career in PEDS ID or in adult ID, there are lots of great programs out there with open positions, including our amazing program here in DC. So if you guys are interested in joining us or any of the other programs, please reach out.
Yeah, love it. And I know I'm not quite as active, but for the Blue Sky, when folks have been sharing that they have programs with open spots, they've been trying to repost those. So if folks have those or know about them, of course, share with everyone. And hopefully we'll have, you know, a few additional ID fellows that will be joining us in the summer.
We have one open spot here at UAV too. Please come join me as well. We have fun here in the South.
Another fantastic program.
Yeah. And so now to focus on, of course, while we have so many amazing guests with us today, is we are going to talk about the Pediatric ID Fellows Cup. I was going to hand it over to Marcy to just kind of maybe tell folks about our sort of newest iteration. For folks who have been listening to Febrile in the past, the probably have a very overlapping Venn diagram with folks who were active participants in the ID Fellows Cup, which is the version that was launched by the folks at University of Alabama, Birmingham. And we had Jeremy Walker on an episode many years ago. I'll make sure to link it in the consult notes.
Yes. So if you are not familiar with the ID Fellows Cup, it is a friendly competition designed to basically review some ID Fellow level board content while integrating available free online resources that can be helpful for your sort of day-to-day clinical practice and your board preparation as well. And of course, just to kind of generate communication between different sites and just unity amongst our ID community. And the awesome thing about it is that also the actual materials and questions are created by trainees themselves within our ID community and mentored by different faculty across the country. So it's another opportunity to generate some additional scholarly activity from the education side of things. The vision and everything for this was developed by a group of ID physicians across the country, but led by the University of Alabama, where I am right now, using the Kaizen education software. So we leveraged that and got a lot of help from our adult ID friends to create a pediatric version, because before the questions were only adult-based with a few PEDS ID questions sprinkled in there, mostly written by Sarah and some of our other and other amazing MedPEDS folks that were kind of sneaking some Pete questions that were the most missed ones by our adult colleagues. So we wanted to have a Pete specific resource, because as a recently graduated fellow and recently victim of the Pete's ID board, there are very few resources out there for us to be able to study. So just generating more of that and getting the opportunity to other people to create those kind of resources was our main goal. And I want to say that it was a great success. Please, DC. Yes, we are really, really excited. It was an initiative kind of spearheaded by our PEDS education committee and me as an infiltrate of the education committee. And we had great participation. We had 158 players that started the game. And of those, 120 answered all of the questions by the time the cup closed. And 70% of all of our participants were trainees at different levels, all the way from residents to third year or beyond fellows. We also had a little bit of participation by our ID pharmacist friends. We had a couple of them in the cup, some research fellows too, and even a couple of advanced practitioners. So definitely a very diverse cohort that we had for this cup. And of those participants as well, we had 12, so 10% of the ones that finished all of the questions, that actually answered every single question on the day that that was released, which was incredible. Our original intention. And just big shout out to those 12 players. Two of them are here today, Lillian and Barkai. Thank you so much for being such great sports and just doing all of your questions and the release, which was the goal of it, just kind of space, little bits of learning throughout the day. And hopefully that was helpful for you guys.
Yeah. And we thought we would ask you guys, as our, you know, now reigning champions, how you approach the game. Are you guys interacting and encouraging each other to get to the questions? Any sort of feedback on the experience, we would love to hear.
Willie was definitely encouraging.
I think it's a nice way of saying that I was a taskmaster and I made sure everyone did their questions on time. I took my role as team captain very seriously. I was like, we're going to win or we're going to go down trying. So I really good sport about me constantly texting them.
The group chat was really helpful. We had a group chat and that was a great way to remind people to do their questions. So a little tip.
Very nice.
But there was no cheating. There were no answers.
Did you guys feel like there were questions that you debriefed on after or asked each other about?
There were definitely some that some of our faculty members had strong opinions about. Mm-hmm. Dr. Shapiro is not with us today, but yeah, he had some debriefing is maybe the word you could use in the office.
And I want to say, as part of the organizing team, that I was not great at this iteration of encouraging this, but for future iterations, I 100% encourage feedback on the actual structure of the question or in like specific words that may have been misleading. And I know that the adult ID people do this thing called expert consults, where we have someone come and say, I would have actually answered this question a different way for this and this reason. And that can also definitely enhance our learning. So please, everyone, welcome to email our Pete's ID Fellows Cup official email through Instagram or email me directly for future iterations of our cup. And we're happy to include that in our social media posts throughout the cup.
For sure. And our plan is to have these available to folks after the cup is done, obviously, for you to review. And so that feedback on the learning point or the structure, or any other aspects, we can update or provide additional insight on that catalog or database of those questions. So definitely, even if it's after the cup now, we still welcome that so we can continue to adjust it and make it the best resource that it can be.
That's great. It's so nice to have this extra resource. Like we were just saying, there's just not too many questions out there for the PEDS ID board. So this was just fabulous. As a program director, always looking for resources. Thank you.
And I thought some of the infographics too, like were just a great way to reference that and kind of help make it really stick after you answer the question.
Love it. Yeah. And hopefully as we build out more resources that are online outside of course, you know, the primary literature, if there are infographics or podcast episodes or websites that we can link people to, that's the other goal of the way we prepare the answers, that you can click on those and save them on your phone or on your computer. So hopefully the more folks participate, the more things we create, the more things that we can build out and have synergy across all these different sort of platforms available to us.
This was such a great learning experience for me. There were definitely questions that I learned from, and I've been doing this for a while, but always room to learn every day. And so that was great. I do think we did have some fun, robust discussions about some of the questions afterwards. We kind of, at the end of the day, folks who were on service would come out and we'd make sure everyone had done their questions. And then we'd often just have a discussion about the questions. So it was great.
I love it. So we have a handful of the top missed questions, and we thought we would go through them to teach people about the learning points that we were intending, but also your thought process. Who wants to start with question one?
So our first question is, a 15-year-old male was brought to the ED by his father after the first episode of generalized tonic-clonic seizure. The seizure stopped after 5 minutes, and he was back at his baseline before arrival. He reported a history of intermittent headaches during the past year associated with nausea, which has improved with over-the-counter medications. He denied fever, chills, weight change, vision change, weakness, or numbness. He is originally from Myanmar and immigrated to the Midwestern U.S. 5 years ago. He's in high school. He is not sexually active. He loves hiking and gardening. He's a strict vegetarian and does not eat meat. He denies having pets, contact with farm animals, recent travel, or sick contacts. A physical exam in the ED was unremarkable without focal neurologic deficit. Labs including CBC, CMP, toxicology screening, and HIV screening were unremarkable. A brain MRI was obtained. And then it gives us a nice picture of this MRI from multiple different views. The question is, what should be done next? And our answer choices are albendazole monotherapy, anti-epileptic drug and albendazole, anti-epileptic drug, corticosteroid and albendazole, anti-epileptic drug, corticosteroid and neurosurgery consult, and lastly, anti-epileptic drug, corticosteroid, albendazole and neurosurgery consult. What do you guys think is the correct answer?
I think just thinking about not necessarily what the right answer is, but when I was sort of evaluating which one I was going to pick, a kid who comes in with seizures, then you probably want to start an anti-epileptic drug. So that kind of took off answer choice A. And then I feel like any finding in the brain, I'm always like, let's talk to neurosurgery. So that kind of put that on my like radar too. So really, I was kind of down to D and E.
Especially when you have those ominous red arrows on the MRI.
I say, does anyone want to describe what the MRI images are showing for those that aren't able to see them as a part of the question stem?
I think there are cystic lesions scattered throughout the brain. I do see one in the cortex and at least one within the ventricles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be one of the keys to this question. And this is something that I learned from this question too. So thank you so much for the question writers.
Yeah, so maybe someone can take on our final correct answer.
Perhaps one of our third year fellows.
So the answer was answer choice D. So having an anti-epileptic drug, a corticosteroid, and a neurosurgery consult. And I think the tricky part about this was not including albendazole or an antiparasitic agent, because that can lead to a hyperinflammatory state with treatment. And then that other aspect that was already mentioned, that the neurosurgery consult is important to try to help remove some of the cysts.
And I don't think that we ever actually said this, but what clinical syndrome was this case vignette describing?
Neurocysticercosis.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent.
And I think it was interesting that the question stem also mentioned that this patient was a vegetarian. Yeah. I think that was like trying to throw us off maybe, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely wanted folks to remember that neurocysticercosis is going to potentially be able to occur even in someone who's a strict vegetarian if they eat those eggs and contaminated food. And of course, we'll put the resource that has our good old CDC life cycle that people can review. I will also say that this is one that was adapted from the adult cop, and Mac Chestachai, who has been on Federal Podcast for one of our State of the Art reviews, wrote this question. So I'm not even sure he knows that we reuse this question or not.
Thanks, Mac.
Thank you, Mac. Awesome.
I mean, I was just going to say, like, the more advanced take-home message, like Berkai mentioned, is really that there are both intraparenchymal and extraparenchymal lesions. And because there were signs of acute disease, this is maybe different than the classic board stem we see of seizures with a calcified cyst where there's no management indicated. So having those in different compartments does require different treatment. And like one of our other fellows mentioned, making sure that you don't treat to trigger a hyperinflammatory response without steroids and appropriate containment of those active cysts is critical.
I think this was a great question too, because of that. I'll say I got this question wrong, and I was talking to the fellows about it afterwards, and we were talking about seeing these intraventricular lesions with neurocysticercosis. That's not very common. I actually went and looked it up afterwards, because neurocysticercosis isn't a thing we see too commonly in the places that I've practiced in various locations, but I've definitely seen it throughout my career, and I've been doing this a while now, but I've seen maybe about 10 cases. And I've never seen one that actually had intraventricular lesions. I think that point about management is important, because the management is a little bit different with that lesion as opposed to someone who has a calcified cyst, where we would need to do antiparasitics, as Dr. Jantz was just mentioning. When I looked it up, about only 7 to 20% of cases actually present with intraventricular disease. But it was great, and I definitely learned something new.
And I love that key point that you went and looked up something else outside of the app, which is one of the things that we hope that people do.
But don't do it on your phone.
All right. Who wants to take on this next step?
So a 16-year-old previously healthy boy presents with fever, right upper quadrant abdominal pain, and the following findings on the CT imaging. And if I were to describe, I think there's a heterogeneous mass slash cyst looking structure in the liver. he returned from a two-month trip from rural South America 3 weeks ago. He's hemodynamically stable and has no known drug allergies. Which of the following is the most appropriate empiric antimicrobial agent? Personally, this is one of those questions I got wrong. When I read the question stem and the travel history, I was thinking about, okay, so this is going to be an amoebic liver abscess. And I was looking for an answer that will treat that. So I chose one of the wrong options with metronidazole plus paromomycin. But unfortunately, I was incorrect.
Yeah, I picked the same as Berkay initially. So I totally fell in that trap.
And after this question, there was some heated discussion among ourselves, you know, some friendly competition about, like,
I think my lack of knowledge actually helped me with this question because I wasn't even thinking about amoebic etiologies. And so I was like, okay, intra-abdominal abscess, we're going to go with subtractome plus flagellates. So I got it right by mistake.
It's still counted towards the point. So you get.
Team leader says yay.
But yeah, I think, I mean, the tricky thing is common things are common everywhere and you have to really treat and manage those, especially if your patient is otherwise stable, and then do your diagnostic workup to look at the more exotic things. So here, horses instead of zebras in a field that we do deal with a lot of zebras, but it's a little bit tricky.
I have to admit, you know, if I try to put myself in those shoes of getting that call, we have this picture and what are we going to start this patient on? I don't see myself saying paromomycin. I wouldn't have selected that option.
So. Yeah, I think we had a good discussion about this after the question too, about this is they're asking for appropriate empiric therapy. So again, yes, we were all thinking about amoebic liver abscesses and we wanted some coverage for that. And so metronidazole does that. And then we want coverage for some of the other common things that cause pyogenic liver abscesses. So in kids, Staphylococcus aureus, streptococcal species, gram negatives like Klebsiella. And so looking at the options, ceftriaxone plus metronidazole definitely stood out.
Yeah. And I will give a shout out. The author for this one was Maria Valenzuela, who's one of our fellows at Boston Children's.
And one of our former residents.
Yeah. She's
okay. So we will move on to our next question.
I can take that one.
Okay.
So the question is as follows. You're the ID fellow on call and receive a page from a community pediatrician asking for UTI treatment guidance. They tell you that the patient is a previously healthy 3-year-old girl with no prior history of UTIs, whose parents brought her to the office for complaints of her belly hurting and fear of urination. She is afebrile and otherwise well-appearing with only mild suprapubic tenderness. A clean catch urine analysis reveals 4+ leukocyte esterase, 2+ protein, 2+ blood, and positive nitrites. She was sent home on empiric cephalexin while awaiting urine culture results, which return with 100,000 colonies of Escherichia coli. Antimicrobial sensitivity report is shown, and her pediatrician would like to know what, if any, outpatient antibiotic treatment options may be suitable. And so we have a sensitivity report, which shows everything as resistant, except for amikacin and minocycline. So that includes resistance to ampicillin, but also cefazolin, piperacillin, ceftaxime, ceftazidime, and levofloxacin, and Bactrim as well. And so the answer choices here are continue cefalexin, 25 mg per kg per dose, POTID for 7 days, a single dose of IM amikacin, 15 mg per kg, minocycline, 2 mg per kg per dose, POBID for 5 days, a single dose of IM ceftriaxone followed by cefixime, 8 mg per kg, PO once daily for 5 days, and recommend direct admission for treatment with IV meropenem. I thought that one was fairly interesting and made me think of a case that we had recently, but it seems that you're only picking out the ones that I got wrong. Is that like
who feels personally victimized by Sargon?
um Yeah, so someone else want to talk about their thoughts?
Yeah, like maybe someone can let us know like how you process those question answer choices.
Yeah, I only got this question right because of Dr. Shapiro. So shout out to him for teaching me this. So we recently had probably a very common call to get after hours about a patient who has a resistant like ESBL organism in their urine and they don't need to be admitted, but what are we going to treat them with? We had recently just treated a patient with a dose of gentamicin. And so my thought process was, well, why couldn't we do that with amikacin? That seems like it would make sense. And so that was kind of how I thought through that question was, well, obviously cefalexin isn't going to work. Minocycline, yeah, not really something that I do very often. So I'm going to go with not that one. Another cephalosporin for similar reasons, and that because this is an ESBL producer. And then I know our ID pharmacists would come after me with pitchforks if I ever recommended admitting anyone for this reason with meropenem. So I knew that I was not going to choose that one. And that is how I ended up with going with amikacin.
I think that this was a really great question in terms of reminding, you know, clinicians, including myself, that this is a therapeutic option for this population. I feel like in reality, a lot of times we get that call and we say, how's the patient doing now? And most of the time their symptoms have resolved. So likely from some other benefit of concentration of antibiotics in the urine or not needing treatment in the first place. But I think having this in your pocket and this knowledge of the post-antibiotic effect is a really helpful option and something that pediatricians or at least ER doctors can feel empowered by.
Yeah, I want to say it was a great question to like sort of demystify how people just think of aminoglycosides, of like they're just so toxic and so bad and we only use them as adjuvants for the most part in our practice, but they're actually excellent antibiotics to treat urinary tract infections, which is actually the system with like the kidney and nephrotoxicity where people fear them the most. So I think it was a great reminder that we can, as Alex was saying, empower primary care doctors, pediatricians, ER docs to be able to use them and avoid an admission that could create even more problems for these patients. And I want to shout out the author of this question, Lindsay Hastings, MedPeds Fellow Extraordinaire here at the University of Alabama.
Woohoo!
Oh, and to Einar's point, so these are the most missed questions. So you are not alone on having missed these ones. For the neurocystic sarcosis question, only 11% of our question answers actually got it right. For the intra-abdominal abscess, just 28%. And for this aminoglycoside question, 52% got it right.
All right. And let's close it out with our last of these most frequently missed questions.
A 10-year-old male presents after being bitten on the arm by a bat while playing in the woods. Classic. He is otherwise healthy, but completed a full rabies post-exposure prophylaxis regimen 2 years ago after a stray dog bit him. What incredible luck this 10-year-old child has. Which of the following management approaches would best address his need for rabies prevention at this time? Funny enough, I saw a patient around the similar time that I think this question came out where she was receiving rabies prophylaxis. And so that helped me narrow down the question answers, but I still got it wrong because as compared to this patient, my patient in real life did not have a previous rabies exposure.
Yeah, I think it was relatively easy to rule out the answers with the rabies immunoglobulin because this person has been immunized before. But I also learned from this question how to approach these patients because the number of vaccines, like this is not a clinical situation I have encountered before and I have learned from it.
Definitely, I feel like, get lots of questions about rabies prophylaxis as ID doctors. It's probably one of our like most common questions that the fellows, attendings get about prophylaxis. But to have someone who's been previously vaccinated or somebody who was like a veterinarian and previously vaccinated for pre-exposure is rare. I don't think I've ever gotten that question. Shout out to the book and how easy it is to look things up. So in my brain, I don't often keep room for things that I know I can access pretty quickly. So I definitely know what the regimen and what to do for someone who's been bitten who's never had a vaccine before. But I will say this particular scenario, I did not know off the top of my head. So similarly, I was like, well, I don't think they need a rig again. They've had it before. We don't usually do that again. But I was like, yeah, give them all the vaccines anyway. Why not? Let's give them all. So I'll say I definitely got this one wrong.
And so maybe is someone willing to walk through and list what someone would get for post-exposure prophylaxis if they were previously vaccinated versus not, just for the audience members to refresh in their brain too?
Sure. So for post-exposure prophylaxis and those who are not previously vaccinated, you would do the rabies vaccine on days 0, 3, 7, and 14. If you're immunocompromised, it's a little bit different, though, so just that little asterisk there. And then they would also receive rabies immunoglobulin at the site of the bite. If they are previously vaccinated, then you would receive rabies vaccine at days 0 and 3. And then I mentioned the immunoglobulin is not indicated in that case.
And we'll give a shout out to the author of this question, Rebecca Sturgis, who's at Cincinnati Children's. Thank you for this awesome question. So we do just in general want to give a thank you to all the question writers and mentors who contributed and looked at these questions. And we will also have a link. You can click on the episode description and see that there's a call for our next round of writers and mentors. It's a really quick Google Doc. Even if you're on the fence, you know, fill it out and we'll be in touch so that we can work on our next round of questions. And we'll also put the link to the PEDS ID Fellows Cup. We have a website, and if you don't follow our Instagram, you can follow the Instagram for updates. But before we close out, I'll kind of open it up.
Thanks so much, you all, the organizers of the ID Fellows Cup. It was amazing. We had so much fun doing it, and like I said, we learned a lot. So yay, we're looking forward to the next one.
We will be getting t-shirts.
Thank you again to our group from Children's National for joining today and Marisu from UAB. We were really happy to have them join us. And again, just a huge thank you to the febrile community. Hope to hear from many of you in the coming year and keep bringing you new and exciting ID learning. Don't forget to check out our website, febrilepodcast.com, where you can find the consult notes, which are written complements to the episodes with links to references, our library of ID infographics, and a link to our merch store. Febrile is produced with support from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Please reach out if you have any suggestions for future shows or want to be more involved with Febrile. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.